Welcome to the Overthinking It TV recap of Downton Abbey Season 4, American Episode 3, British Episode 4, because of course that first episode in America was a double episode, and of course we have the British versions, we've been watching the British versions, but we're keeping up with you here in the States, being exposed to the glorious and terrible revelations of Season 4 of Downton Abbey. In real time, as they were meant to be discussed. I am here. It is an intimate drawing room conversation that will no doubt skirt to matters scandalous and matters proprietous before it jerks its way back to the tea and cakes. But I've got one guest with me here on the panel today, who's Matt Rather. How are you doing, Matthew?
I shall spend the rest of these recaps paying by installments.
Indeed. Well, we are the caretakers of these recaps, so let's take care of them. Last week, we kind of had to process.
Yeah, I mean, if it were a mob movie, right, Pete, it would be a different thing. It would be like, hey, you're going to spend the rest of your life paying by installments. I mean, we are the caretakers, so we're going to take care of you.
I'm already full of regrets. There's nothing but regret in me. When the woman you love loves you, it doesn't change anything. It changes you. From where I'm looking, yes, we should definitely. Downtown Abbey is the or Abbey Downtown is the Italian American mob movie that is a shot for shot remake of Downton Abbey, just with different intonations. Edith, she's as mysterious as a bucket. but yes, yeah. But there were a lot of lines that would have read differently were they said by Damon Runyon characters, but that is not what we're here to do today. I do like that we're reaching a certain lightheartedness again. I mean, it's perhaps not entirely warranted, but last week we had to process the trauma of poor Anna's assault, which felt somewhat like a discontinuity in the show, and one that the show is going to have to continue to digest.
I forget whether I said this on the podcast or whether I said this to you, but, you know, it put the rest of the season, which I've watched all of, into like two modes, right? One is when we're dealing with this, and two is everything else on the show, right?
Exactly.
And so there's this sort of disjunction, there's this sort of like splitting as a viewer that happens with me, where you kind of split off this little part of the show and sort of bracket it, kind of like processing a trauma, you know, in your life.
Yeah,
and I don't mean to trivialize Anna's terrible sexual assault by saying it's kind of like watching a TV show where something you dislike happens, but. It's not unlike that.
Yeah. Well, lest we blame ourselves too desperately, remember that it didn't actually happen and is merely a fictional event. But it's very, very different from Tom's assault, which was somewhat sexualized but not quite as sexual last season, where it was more of a piece with what was happening. And I think that's sort of been – we've certainly on these recaps treated Downton Abbey as a show – who a lot of the charm and beauty of it and the art of its construction of its individual episodes comes from the fact that events that have broadly different societal purposes or just purposes in general have consonance with one another as they are happening, right? You know, the Dowager Countess picks a particular tea, and it's similar to whether or not Violet is going to pick a particular job, and it's similar to whether, like, you know, Daisy is going to talk to Alfred or Jimmy. Like, these things didn't all happen at the same time in the show, but these are examples of the kind of events that have a certain consonance to them and that they're all sort of happening at the same time. And they're happening in the same way. And there's a connection of tone, and the music links it, and the lighting links it, and the costuming links it. And there's this sense that all of it is kind of marching chin up, lifting its petticoat slightly towards a plank that it's going to like plunge into the ocean off of. And that makes it all the more beautiful. But, in this case, yes, we have a discontinuity. We have a part of the show that sort of gets yanked out of the rest of the show, gets bracketed, and gets put into its own place. And it has something to do with the rest of the show, but yeah, you'd have to be really insensitive, I think, to be able to feel a tonal consonance, feel a tonal unity between what is happening in this episode and now. And again, I haven't seen any of the future episodes. I've just seen up to this episode, and you've seen the whole thing, so we have different perspectives. But in this episode where, you know, we see the first real fruits of the damage that this assault is doing to Anna and Mr. Bates' relationship. And that's just so rough to watch, right?
It's rough to see it happen between them, and also to get those sort of misogynistic and period appropriate, I suppose, but that those sort of misogynistic thoughts that, that Anna has about how she is soiled and how sort of something is wrong with her.
Yeah.
And that this sort of guilt, in the wake of this, you know, which honestly is still a problem today, though I'd like to think our society's understanding of the, you know, victims of rape has progressed.
Right.
But it's like, but for Anna, you know, she lives it, she believes in her guilt, you know, it's somehow something's wrong with her. And, you know, society would agree somehow,
yeah.
Right? Like, or that, you know, or that, like, it struck, oh, I want to get into this later, but it struck me that, that a lot of this episode is about sort of the difference between women and men, the way that, that society is a sort of feminized and sort of female run in some sense, structure that is meant to keep the men bridled somehow, because the idea is that the men cannot control their sort of appetitive, lustful, acquisitive, or whatever drives of various kinds, and that, you know, the women need to do them. And it, I mean, it strikes me that, like, who is paying by installments, right? And like the idea for Tom with Edna Braithwaite, right? Like, you know, seducing him and taking advantage of his drunken state. He could spend the whole rest of his life paying by installments, right? Like, a baby is the ultimate installment plan.
Right?
It's the loan that you never pay off.
18 years. She hath one of your kids. We'll cut you for 18 years. That's, I believe that's Kanye West by way of Ray Charles, by way of the Dowager Countess, right? Like, but I'm not saying that she's a gold digger.
I'm saying that she's a gold. But she is messing with a formerly broke chauffeur. The idea that, like, Tony just now shows up in a way that is, like, slightly creepy stalkerish. Like, there's a lot of Tony, you know, like, he from the house party, and then he shows up at dinner at Rosamond's, and then he shows up back at Downton Abbey, you know. The fella who's dancing with Rose, who, you know, sort of gets too drunk and then gets too, like, humpy with his dancing with Rose in the middle. Yeah. And that, by the way, I think that, like, posh club is meant to echo the dance hall that she was in before, where another fight broke out over her, right? Because these men are always fighting over Rose, and as the object of all these men fighting about her around her, Rose has to, like, keep them calm and placated and satisfied and not dance with the black guy.
Right, which is, of course, oh, man. I mean, I think it does tie back to the extent that we've said that the unities of these episodes has been somewhat damaged by the introduction of this rather extreme plot. I do think in watching it, you know, going through it a second time, really, the thing we mentioned, the scene with Mary and Robert talking about how their plans are to pay for the tax bill for Matthew's death, really does show a gender dynamic that cuts throughout the episode, which is that, you know, Robert wants to sell parts of the land and pay off the tax bill in one lump sum. And Mary wants to incur a debt that she has to pay back by installments and fulfill by being a caretaker for the estate. And it's notable that, like, Robert is very dismissive of this. Like, oh, I'll be paying by installments. Yeah, like, this isn't really something that ought to be my job. And throughout this whole episode, we see instances of men who want it all in one lump sum versus women who are in a position to be the regulators and to say it needs to happen at this pace at this time, right? Like, either I'm not ready or I don't want to or you're crazy, but for whatever reason, or like, you're dangerous, right? Like, you can't be controlled. This needs to happen in accordance with a timetable. And that, as much as anything else, is kind of the unifying theme of this episode for me.
I'm going to be that asshole and be the jerk who draws a parallel between the Anna plot and the rest of the plots. The idea that she has to keep quiet, right? Because she is the regulator of Bates's murderous rage.
Yes.
You know, exactly. That he's going to tee off on whoever, you know, soiled her, and better a broken heart than a broken neck. And we were talking about, we were talking about this, like the game, a Game of Thrones solution to a Downton Abbey problem, or I suppose rather a Downton Abbey solution to a Game of Thrones problem, which is that between playing the Game of Thrones, you either win or you die. But there's a lot of territory between win and die. Right.
Yes.
And and so like there
I mean that's what Downton Abbey is about, is like the period of time between right. when they won and when they died. Everything that they do in the meantime. But yeah. Their way of life, them as individuals. It's definitely a different sort of model. What is it? What is the exact phrasing for like, oh, that's so and so for an Englishman, oh, that's
That's strong talk for an Englishman. when Robert is reassuring Bates that he's going to pull through with Anna. When two people love each other as you do, it is bound to work out for the best. And he says, "Wow, that's strong talk. That's strong talk for an Englishman." But I think that this gender dynamic, I think, is very uncomfortable, or at least I find it uncomfortable from a modern perspective. And recently there has been some spilling of ink in like editorial pages and op-eds and things like this, by Maureen Dowd, who accused the show of sort of whitewashing, the bad time her grandmother had as a Irish domestic servant or something like that. With due respect to Maureen Dowd's grandmother, I think this is an instance where the show is kind of not whitewashing the like sort of terrifically ugly. If you take a lot of these things down to the assumptions that undergird them, they're pretty ugly. Right, like the gender dynamics, like the stuff about victims of sexual assault, the dressing down that Rosamund gives to Edith. What were you about to say, Pete?
Oh, you mean like things that are ugly? I think the relationship between Carson and his vaudeville buddy is kind of an ugly relationship that involves a lot of what you're talking about. Although I'm not sure if it's exactly the same, and it's not
well,
quite
it's,
as
I, right, but that like it comes down to like he stole his girl, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and right. So that the idea that like sort of Downton is this, kind of gauzy, rose colored place, right? It maybe doesn't hold water in light of the fact that it seems very, I mean, a lot of these things seem very, not non-contemporary if you unpack them a little bit.
You mean non-contemporary with the time frame of the show?
No. I mean, sorry, they seem uncomfortable to us, the viewers, with our current day sensibility.
Because the show kind of cuts both ways.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The show both takes, and we referenced this a little earlier in the episode, the show takes events and characters and situations kind of drawn from history and very clearly alters them to make them more comfortable to a modern sensibility. Right? Like, Thomas is the most obvious example from this since day one, where an audience earlier in time would not have been comfortable with the character of Thomas. Thomas is very much a contemporary character. Closeted, but sort of openly closeted Caddy Butler, right? And like the complexity of his sexuality and the threat his sexuality presents is something that he's very aware of and that everybody around him is aware of. And we're aware of it. The self-awareness of the gender and sexual dynamic of Thomas is something that is like a post-Queer Eye for the Straight Guy way of looking at things, right? Like it's post-Brokeback, right? Like
it's back is broken.
It's back indeed. But like at the same, and there are a bunch of other situations like this where it's like, oh, you know, this character who is drawn from this sort of story that we've seen a bunch of times, let's update that character so that people are more comfortable looking at that character's experiences. And then at the same time, there are situations that might be more comfortable for us contemporarily, but are then made like less comfortable by being deliberately pointed out to us that they are not the way that they are now. And I guess that is also kind of a recontextualization of a similar sort. But it's like, Anna and Bates is a great example where it's like, can't you see how different things are? I mean, Thomas, anytime Thomas was under threat or suffered because of his sexuality, it was like, can't you see how different things are? You know, these people can't do what we would think that they would do. And there's a dramatic irony to that, which means that in the dialectic of the show, there is this sort of unspoken, comfortable 21st century, you know, fantasy of how this all might play out. Right, like as almost as if it's a video game or a LARPing session that's put together for the experience of modern people. I mean, it's an entertainment, so it's like that. But it's not. It's not, we're not seeking a verisimilitude, is what I mean. Like we're not seeking a way in which these people are analogous to and similar to their analogs that lived in history. We are using the tropes. We are using the symbols. We're using the whole oeuvre, not the oeuvre, the paradigm. As a way of telling the contemporary stories and of also drawing contrasts that tell us more about who we are now than who they were then,
yeah.
I suppose. So that's like basic, that's like Downton 101. And that's like what the Dowager Countess is always sort of talking about, right? Is like the sort of, well, the things that you obviously know, right? Like this, I understand the arc of history, so let me tell you about it. Well, right? Like,
there's another, what did she say? Another brick pulled from the wall when Robert is wearing black tie.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I mistook you for a waiter. And then when Edith is going off to Michael Gregson, she says, "Oh, and that's another thing we have to look forward to. That's the next thing we have to look forward to." As though her conception of the dialectic of history was one of kind of death by a thousand cuts, right? Like small indignities and small failures of the social order leading to eventual collapse.
Yeah, the whole idea of like you don't have doesn't mean you have to eat off a tray from the previous episodes.
Yes.
I love the idea by the way that like the Dowager Countess is sort of disdainfully concerned with bricks being drawn from the wall, and I love thinking about that as a counterpoint to Pink Floyd's The Wall, right? All these things being another brick in the wall in this sort of cataclysmic, you know, dystopian way. You know, it's like, oh, the nobles with their white ties and their livery and their black jackets with their tails, it's all another brick in the wall, right? And then the Dowager Countess being like, well, there goes another brick from the wall that we were building. It definitely something in there that is I don't know, retconning, a little bit self-aware, retconning the subjugation of the British mind by the aristocracy.
Well, that's what, that's what the Dowager Countess does, right? Like pouring her derision down on everything they did, exposing every weakness, however carefully hidden by her kid, Robert.
Well, you see, if you don't eat your meat, you can't have any pudding. How can you have any pudding if you don't eat your meat? Oh, man. But anyway, just talking about the installment plans, like sort of using that as kind of the go back to. So, yes, there's Carson and the loss of his love of his life, which he considered to have happened all at once, but in fact, like, happened in installments, like, without his knowledge, right? In that, like, there was a long period of time where she was in love with him, but sort of made do and continued to stay with the man that she wasn't really in love with, right? Like, and then, you know, in that sense, this should be a good thing for Carson, right? And then we can look at the opposite of what we said before. The men seem to be uncontrollable and emotionally inconsolable and like need to be taken care of because they can't cope with change. But at the same time, we could pose the question of to what degree is the delay or the installment planning that's being suggested something that actually is to their advantage were they to do it. Right, like
right. Edith's way is Mary's way, rather, is very modern. Right, like you can run a business on cash flow. You know,
yeah.
You can run the estate on cash flow. Right, like, and they're sort of generating and the kind of the plot that's going on around the estate is that, you know, they're instituting Matthew's modernizations, which, you know, have to do with using the estate as a way of sort of generating regular income. That is to say, going into business and not just getting it all in rents from tenant farmers, right? Being able to sort of work and farm the land themselves. There have been some plans about livestock, you know. Tell me, what is this about you giving up sheep?
Well, it's not so simple as all that.
Well, Mom. Yeah, right. That you know, that this, and this is a kind of a piece with the you know, ascendant professional class bourgeois Matthew, right? And so Edith is kind of doing it with Edith is kind of doing it in the name of modernizing and also in the name of her dead husband.
You mean Mary?
Mary.
Yeah.
I don't know why I keep getting those two mixed up.
It's because Edith looks so much more glamorous this season.
I know. She does, doesn't she? She's she's definitely, without without Sybil, they're definitely putting her in the cool 20s fashions. And so much so that she does it with a guy.
I know, right? Jeez, the walk of shame hath never been done so proudly with such great.
Sort of. She's about as subtle. I mean, as what does she say? Edith's about as mysterious as a bucket. I mean, she's trudging in, and the maid sees her. You know, my God, watch out for the maid. That's like upstairs downstairs rule 101, right? Like, don't let the maid see you.
Yeah, and, you know, this is interesting because this dichotomy we've discussing between feminine characters who are caretakers and installment planners and male characters who need everything immediately. Edith, thinking this puts Edith in the context of being a male sort of character, right? In that she wants what she wants right now. To wait, and she's unwilling to sort of play the role of the good woman in this relationship to the degree that even her aunt is horrified, right? That she thinks that these things have changed so much. Now that makes me sort of think back about Edith and think back about Edith's difficulty getting along with her sister, right? Her difficulty getting along with Mary, and I mean her difficulty getting along with Sybil too. But Sybil's a saint now that she's passed. But you know, everything gets forgiven, but is there a degree to which Edith has always been like a little bit more masculine, or at least been not as good as being a woman, and like sort of the responsibilities that being a noble woman requires you to have, in terms of like delayed gratification, controlling your impulses. I mean, of course, Mary is the. Man, there's a couple different directions. One I feel like I have to reference right now. I know we're going on a bit of a tangent. Is how far has Mary come from Pamuk,
right?
So because Mary wanted it all at once, right? Mary was, you know, jumping the horse over the muddy area or the log or whatever it was, just like a man would. And Mary was sort of exploring this aspect of her sexuality and herself, and didn't hold back and didn't regulate and didn't make plans and did it with Pamuk. And of course, Pamuk dies, right? And there's horrible consequences. But how much different now is the Mary who, like, delays and delays and then ultimately rejects? Is it Tony's entreats, right? Entreaties, than the Mary who, like, couldn't resist Pamuk? I mean, the horse ride that they go on together, right? Isn't that a mirror of the horse ride that she ends up going on with Pamuk, right? Isn't that like a. And that was last episode, right? Or was that the beginning of this episode? It all gets mixed up to me in this one. Might have been last episode where Tony and Mary go horseback riding and nobody else wants to go horseback riding with them. Might have even been earlier in the season, but I feel like it particularly hits home given the themes of this particular episode in terms of like instant gratification versus delayed gratification and self-control versus kind of being the person that other people need to control. But in the first episodes where Mary is going horseback riding, she sort of inadvisedly goes off with Pamuk by herself. And everybody else is out there horseback riding and she could be with them, but she doesn't. And in this one, by now, she wants other people to go horseback riding with her. She wants to be in the group of people that are sort of mutually protective of each other, especially each other's sexuality in this case because she's so vulnerable. But she ends up being forced to go alone with Tony because no one else will go with her because everyone else has moved on from horseback riding. And then when this situation is presented to her, which is a Pamukish sort of situation, he doesn't even look entirely unlike Pamuk. He's like darker with the dark eyebrows, right? And he's kind of mysterious, not as mysterious as the Turkish envoy, you know, or what have you, but like mysterious. And she has every opportunity to sort of legitimately accept his advances. I mean, he wants to rush things, right? And how much has she changed that she is just not capable, not even capable. It assumes that it's something that she would want to do. She just doesn't want to do it. She just says no, right? Like, she just doesn't want to do it anymore. And what a difference is that? And what an antonym is that to what's happened earlier on to her character back when she was a little bit more of a, I'd say even more of a challenger to the status quo in kind of storybook sort of ways, rather than now where she's a challenger to the status quo in like Forbes magazine kind of ways, apparently. She's done what, look, peeping through the keyhole, and now she's leaning in. but yeah, I mean, what do you have to say about, I mean, I jumped through a lot of things there, and I was still was talking about how,
well,
like,
let me take it down the other way and talk about Edith, right? Remember the last guy that Edith took up with who left her at the altar,
yes.
That was who jilted her. Well, not jilted her, who left her at the altar. And,
isn't that what jilting means though?
Oh, is it? I thought it had something to do with infidelity. No, I guess you're right. Of course.
Well, I mean, formally, I think it's used in a lot of different contexts. I know it's also a magic card, but to suddenly reject or abandon. Yes.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So indeed.
It's from mid 17th century, deceive or trick of unknown origin.
So, that guy, if you recall, was like an early adopter of the automobile and
yes.
was teaching Edith to drive. And I thought that Edith, it seemed to me that Edith sort of belonged in the world of machines, right? Like Edith was and maybe this makes her more masculine in the terms of the show, but she didn't belong in the world of the drawing room. She belonged in the world of maybe the professions or of factories or of the machines, right? Like
yeah.
her motion was the motion of an automobile forward. It wasn't the sort of graceful spinning around the ballroom, you know, that you could see with Mary or now with Rose, you know, 20s dancing, jazz dancing around. Jazz dancing around the dance clubs and dance halls and whatnot, right? And that there was something more modern in that sense.
Thoroughly modern Edith, right?
Yeah, so sure. Right?
Yeah.
And it turned out, I mean, like it almost would have been better, except that she was supposed to have been the plain one who couldn't get a man, right? It would have been better for her to take up with Branson in a way rather than have Sybil take up with Branson, right? Like, because Sybil would have gone on to be the Rose of the show, right? And be the young pretty one. But, you know, I don't know. These actors all seem to be eager to jump ship from the hit show. So we lost... lost Sybil and lost Matthew. And
Sybil died in childbirth, and Matthew was killed in a tragic Christmas special automobile accident. I don't know what you're talking about, these actors leaving the show.
Right.
These were essential organic parts of the story. I had a thought while you were saying that, and I think that's totally true, because there's different images of modernity that arise out of the 1920s in particular. And one of them is, and also the teens and 20s, but one of them is what I would associate with sort of futurism, right? Like this, the Italian-based movement of like, you know, mankind will eat ball bearings and will be fast like trains. And like, you know, the coming technological revolution will fundamentally change the way that we think about ourselves and our souls. And there was a lot of sort of speculative energy and art that came out of this movement. And it was, and you see it in movies like you know, Metropolis is kind of related to this sort of thing, and like Edith is along with these sorts of things. It's also what I mean. I've been playing a lot of Civilization lately, and it's what I associate with, like, you know, in Civilization 2, the wonder of the world, women's suffrage, is unlocked by the technology industrialization, right? Like, as such, like, I consider Edith to be part and parcel of like those things relative to the other women. You know, Mary has the future kind of in a different sort of aspect. I mean, previously she was the one who was going to get married, and it was going to be like the sort of romantic story. And of course, that's changed due to contract disputes. I was looking up. I decided to look up Edith's name, is what I'm saying. And I looked up the meaning of the name Edith, and I'm looking at it up on Wikipedia now. And apparently, it's a combination of a couple of different meanings. One is riches or blessedness. So, and the other one is war. So those things together, and then also a little bit of God and beautiful in there. But it's a combination of words from Old English, German, and Dutch. And it communicates this combination between wealth and war and beauty, which also interesting. I don't think this is necessarily on purpose, but to me, these ideas together are very much imbued in the rising tide of automation and machinery. Right, this battle, this destructive battle that's coming, that's going to change the world and grind things up, and also just the very, you know, machines of war themselves that are themselves great creators of wealth and also great blessings, right, to people who need them. Of course, Mary as a name is much more of like, you know, there's no more old school of a name than Mary. And I don't even know. I guess Sybil is the riddle, right? Like Sybil is. I'm looking at the. No, see, now I just get disambiguation.
The name database?
Yeah, well, now, I mean, it just brings up the oracles, right? And I don't think Sybil was necessarily an oracle, although maybe she did sort of tell a future that nobody really understood in her wanting to be with a commoner, or maybe with an Irish person, but I don't know. The future belongs to the Irish is what that Sybil was prophesying. Aaron Copra. But anyway, I got carried away on all that stuff a little bit. But I do like the Mary who is now the sort of queen of the castle, because Mary is the steward of Downton, the caretaker of Downton. She it seems now more than anyone else is going to be the through line. Whatever state Downton ends up being in, it will probably not be far removed from Mary's own. Right, like so. Either if Mary is to endure much as she is, and sort of resist the encroaching changes around her, then she will help Downton do that as well. Right, and if she fails to do those things, then Downton will fail to do those things, and she will like walk away from it with the lights out, like Sam Malone. Right, like and it seems like that Mary is the heart and the mother of Downton at this point. Now that Matthew is gone and he can't be part of it.
Sure, and in her sort of. Feminine capacity for exploitation of natural resources, right? Yeah. In a certain amount of vulnerability and a certain amount of untapped potential, she is her state is kind of like the state of the estate, right? But in that, you know, I don't know, they are both ripe for development, for economic development.
Right. All right, so there's no name meaning other than Sybil, other than the prophet, and Mary name meaning. At this point, it's so loaded. Mary, what? Oh, never mind.
there's a last thing to talk about, which is this plot.
If we're real-time Googling, we've pretty much finished what we need to talk about.
Which is what happens.
The show would know that it's a proud tradition.
Is to generate material for the show by just searching Wikipedia for things.
Yeah.
I thought that the humiliation visited on poor Edna for the crime of seducing Branson, Tom, was really awful. Right, like, sure, you know, what she did was sneaky and underhanded and not good, but you know, I don't know, that to be sort of threatened with, like, we're going to have a forced OBGYN exam and we'll see what the doctor says about you, or, you know, like, we're going through your stuff, right? Like, this is another thing that I found from a, you know, 21st century point of view, very deeply uncomfortable, right? Like, the idea that, like, certain liberties or certain privacy is protected is not, you know, doesn't exist in the life of these servants, and it's touched on only, you know, it's touched on very gently, but it is touched on, that, like, you know, even though she's bad, you know, she is a person and has rights, and having her stuff not rifled through is probably one of them, you know.
I mean, there's a reason why we fought the British to get those rights, Matt. Because they wouldn't let us have them. No, I don't think it's that simple.
For goodness sake, next thing you'll be quartering soldiers in our houses, you know?
Season two, Matt? Season two. By the way, Mary, the name Mary, rebelliousness, sea of bitterness, wished for child and beloved. So yes, that is pretty descriptive of the character of Mary in the show. But yeah, I guess they were a little bit harsh on the, I don't know, what can we say, right? Like, the British crown does not abide baby mama drama in any form and crushes it with an iron fist. But yeah, I guess they treated her pretty cruelly. Although it's hard not to see her as a villain. It's a strange plot line, and I don't particularly look forward to it coming back more in the season. And if it doesn't, then I don't really understand why it was here in the first place. But other than, of course, I guess to call into question Branson's comfort with his role currently in this household. But I don't know. I guess we'll have to save that for future episodes, aren't we, Matt?
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. Maybe she'll become a Nazi in Edith's crazy Nazi adventure, which is still coming. Still coming, I tell you. But from here on out, I think we need to leave the conversation to you. So if you want to talk about Season 4, Episode 4 American, Episode 3 American, Episode 4 British, if you want to talk about Downton Abbey in general, you want to talk about the discontinuity or lack thereof if you fail to see it or refuse to see it or decline to see it or see otherwise of the Anna Bates divide. If you are interested in installment plans, if you want to go to culinary school for free, or if you want to write down which character in Downton Abbey, here's the challenge for the commenters this week. Which character in Downton Abbey do you think should go to culinary school for free? You could pick anyone from any season. Matt, who would you pick?
Who I'm going to be?
No, if there's any character from any season of Downton Abbey who should take the offer that Alfred was talking about to go to culinary school for free,
yeah.
Who do you think it should be?
I'm going to go with, I can't even come up with a clever one.
I'm going to say the horribly burned amnesiac from season 2, who's going to make a bang up chicken cordon bleu. Like, you just watch. If you just believe, then he will achieve. But to accomplish all these things and more, to answer these questions and join the conversation, please visit us on the web at www.overthinkingit.com, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably doesn't deserve.